Welcome to Voice of Albion with Paul Hickman on the White Network.
Mr. Duke, ladies and gentlemen, fellow whites, I'd like to thank Mr. Duke and all those others concerned for this invitation to come and speak to you here this weekend. I've enormously enjoyed the visit. I've enormously enjoyed meeting such wonderful people and hope to enjoy meeting more this evening and tomorrow. Nothing but gratitude. Perhaps I may be permitted a few words of introduction of myself in the context of this occasion. I'm one of those well able to understand how David Duke is feeling right now in his first month of freedom. I've been where he's just been. In 1986, I was sent to jail for the 4 months, well, 6 month sentence I did for writing and publishing words liable to stir up racial hatred. Not an offense here in America, yet. Though I'm well aware that certain people are working on this right now. So, as one heretic to another, perhaps I ought to suggest to Mr. Duke that we get together, with one or two others that are here as well, to form a patriotic ex-jailbirds association. How about that? Now, when I was given my freedom after sentence in 1986, I too had a welcome back meeting and said something which could do with repeating now. I said that history provides a number of examples of the truth that those who are in jail today may well be in power tomorrow. Yeah. I also said, pointing out to history once again, that those who are in power today might well be in jail tomorrow. This is a particularly appropriate time to dwell on that theme, because we have many politicians in your country and mine, perhaps thousands or even tens of thousands, who should rightly be in jail for the crimes they've committed against our people. I've always enjoyed coming to America. I've always been greatly interested in America, and I've always thought that no one with the least knowledge of history, the history and development of your country, could possibly believe in the current madness of racial equality. Here is a great continent of boundless wealth, but which was just a wilderness before the coming of the white man. It was the white man and white women who tamed it, developed it, ran it, built it, and created a civilization here. And yet now the white people are being asked to surrender that civilization in the name of race equality. I say again, who can possibly know the history of America and still believe in race equality? I ask a similar question about the leaders of the church, the clergy, the priesthood. These people spend their working lives surrounded by the artifacts of the genius of the white man. They gaze up to the towering heights of the great cathedrals, St. Peter's, Rome, Chartres, Burgos, Cologne, Lincoln, Durham, and see the intricate carvings, the work of ordinary artisans of our race, working centuries ago, before all the modern implements of building were introduced, cranes and so on, using primitive wooden scaffolding, which could well collapse under them, and sometimes did, when there were many, many hundreds of feet up, creating these wonderful works in our cathedrals. Even those who minister in the smaller churches, in their many, many thousands around the white world, must get a feel every day of their working lives of the white man's heritage of skill and creativity, if only by beholding the beautiful stained-glass windows, or hearing the glorious religious music, the St. Matthew Passion, the Missa Solemnis. In the whole vast length and breadth of Africa, nothing has been produced over thousands of years to equal one small movement of a string quintet by Schubert. Or one small cornice in the corner of the Sistine Chapel created by Michelangelo. The noise has emanated from Africa across the centuries, together with that we hear coming from that African outpost, Detroit, or Liverpool, or Birmingham. Nothing of this, all that noise, is not worth those few bars of a Schubert quintet, or any of the great religious music of the great masters of European music. The clergy and the priesthood, they live more closely to this heritage than any of us. Yet we find them everywhere in the vanguard of the movement to pull down white civilization and promote multiracialism, which means, of course, as Sam Dixon has pointed out brilliantly earlier on today, the death of our people. Every day of our working lives, we're surrounded by the marvels of modern technology. We work with the brilliant inventions of our ancestors and our contemporaries. But do we pause to think that about 90% of these great inventions can be traced to just three countries, the United States, Britain, and Germany? I'm sure almost everybody does think about these things, but it's not the done thing to talk about it in polite company. It leads us along the murky paths of political incorrectness, which end with the universally feared bogey of racism. Your compatriot Neil Armstrong, when he set foot on the moon back in 1969, said, "One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind." Well, Mr. Armstrong, who very rightly is a national hero in this country, was being diplomatic. It wasn't a giant leap for mankind. It was a giant leap specifically for white mankind.
Welcome to the Voice of Albion on the White Network. I have agreed to Carolyn Yeager's kind invitation to do a Sunday podcast, which will go out every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I intend to cover nationalist figures past and present. I will also do some interviews, but will not be going live for the time being. To begin, I have decided to cover John Tyndall, leader of the National Front and leader and founder member of the British National Party and the editor of the magazine Spearhead. On 16th July 1986, John Tyndall took up residence in Wormwood Scrubs Prison in West London, having been jailed for breaking the law under Section 5A of the Public Order Act, in that he published words deemed to be liable to stir up racial hatred against other groups. For the first time in a long while, he had the time to write a book. He called it The 11th Hour, A Call for British Rebirth. I purchased a signed copy of the third edition of The 11th Hour at the 8th John Tyndall Memorial Meeting recently. Over the next few podcasts, I will summarise Mr. Tyndall's words and beliefs as set out in his book. Before we start at the beginning of John Tyndall's life, it is necessary to first look at his final years. The segment you heard at the beginning was a speech John Tyndall gave in America in 2004. John Tyndall's magazine Spearhead was his own until his death, and he kept copyright of it. Before we look at The 11th Hour, I'm going to read some of an article he wrote for Spearhead in January 2005. It was penned just 6 months before his death. The article is called Fingers in the BNP. It can be found at spearhead.com. And the article goes, John Tyndall asks, is the BNP infiltrated by hostile agents? As can be seen from the report on page 4 of Spearhead magazine last month, I was expelled from the British National Party for the second time in 16 months. The charges were as ludicrous this time as they were the previous time. Then I took legal action to obtain reinstatement, and I was successful. To avoid the matter going to court and very big costs being incurred, Party Chairman Nick Griffin agreed to an out-of-court settlement whereby the expulsion was annulled and my membership restored. As it was, the action was expensive due to a procedural error by my solicitors in notifying Mr. Griffin of the application for judicial review of the case. The judge hearing the costs application ruled that each party to the dispute pay its own costs. A total bill of over £12,000 resulted from the fiasco, which was split roughly equally. The cause of nationalism in Britain, never abounding in affluence, was that much the poorer for Mr. Griffin's folly. Just what the cost will amount to in the new action which I have been forced to institute over this latest expulsion remains to be seen, but the affair will not be dealt with cheaply. No one regrets more than I do the fact that law nationalists will again be asked to dig deep into their pockets to pay, but the dispute has not been of my making. I never had Mr. Griffin expelled. He had me expelled, twice. A study of the history of Nick Griffin's involvement in national politics indicates that he gets rather a kick out of expelling people or, if not that, proscribing them, which amounts to almost the same thing. In an October 2003 issue of Spearhead, we took a look at a document titled Attempted Murder, of which Mr. Griffin was the main author. This chronicled the internal quarrels that convulsed the National Front in 1986, in which he, Griffin, stood right at the centre. As a sample of paranoia, it takes some beating, and it should be studied by everyone who wants to arrive at some understanding of the troubles now besetting the BNP. Attempted Murder can be read online at www.aryanunity.com/attemptedmurder.html. But this would only touch the surface of these troubles. There is much more that is needed to explain what is now going on in our party than the personality of Chairman Nick. We need to step back for a moment and focus on the bigger picture. This is important because, for the many letters and emails that I receive from nationalists around the country, I sense that an awful lot of people are utterly confused. The political climate in Britain is now more favourable to us than it ever has been. Despite the disappointments of last June's round of elections, both European and municipal, we are still getting some hugely encouraging votes. We should be on the crest of a wave of high morale and optimism, with our ranks united and our tails up. Yet the BNP is racked with internal division and widespread demoralisation, a truth which is only superficially concealed by the upbeat spin that comes from official publications and bulletins. Right now, one of the party's best organisers in the South of England is under suspension, with his branch virtually in a state of limbo, only a probable 5 months from a vital general election. Another excellent organiser, in the East Midlands, has just been expelled. Welcome to the club. A leading activist in the London area only reported to me just before Christmas the alarming state of dissatisfaction among members throughout the capital and its suburbs. Just what is happening? I will endeavour to give my own up-to-date take on the situation. It is one which necessarily requires a certain amount of repetition, over which I hope readers will bear with me. The repetition must begin with some words quoted in these pages in our March 1999 issue. They come from a report in the Express newspaper published on 18 February of that year, and they read: Scotland Yard and MI5 are planning a huge covert operation to break up violent racist organisations. The Express has learned that intelligent officers will infiltrate far-right groups such as the British National Party. Other officers will tap telephones, open mail and scrutinise bank accounts and medical records. We plan to close down these organisations by using every administrative device available to us, said a Yard source. I believe that we must constantly keep these words in the forefront of our minds if we are to make sense of what has been happening to our party in the near 6 years that have followed. And it is perhaps the right place and moment for a further quote. More recently, as the National Front declined to a mere rump, the British National Party has been seen as more dangerous. By the early 1990s, MI5 had successfully recruited or turned several agents inside the BNP. These words come from a book, Defending the Realm, by Mark Hollingsworth and Nick Fielding, published by Andrew Deutsch in 1999. I have no way of ascertaining the sources of the writer's information, but I have to presume that they carried out considerable research into the workings of MI5, the established main internal security service, and would have had no reason to invent their claim. They are almost certainly no friends of the BNP, and would not have made it to do us any favours. So, you can read the rest of that article. It's on spearhead.com, www.spearhead.com, and it's called Fingers in the BNP. Now, before John Tyndall died, he had been charged with race hatred a second time. It might have been a third time, but it was going to Crown Court, this time for a speech in Burnley. During the speech, a plant had been recording covertly. John Tyndall died 2 days before he was due in court.
Very recently, Burnley had the dubious honour of a visit from Mr. Michael Heck, otherwise known as Michael Howard. Heck, sorry, Howard, goes on to say, the policies of the British National Party are based on bigotry and hatred. Its approach is entirely alien to our political traditions. As for alien, Mr. Howard says, alien to our, and I underline our, political traditions. Who is Mr. Howard speaking of when he talks about our? Who is Mr. Howard speaking of when he talks about, uses the word alien? How far do Mr. Howard's roots in this country of ours go back? His father and mother came here as Jewish immigrants from Romania in the late 1930s. This interloper, this immigrant or son of immigrants, who has no roots at all in Britain, has the effrontery to talk to us about what is alien. It is not the BNP that is alien. While this part of Britain was the industrial centre of the world, what was happening in Africa and Asia? The people there were squatting for century upon century upon century on the ground of Africa, and what did they produce apart from black magic, witchcraft, voodoo, capitalism, and AIDS? That is what they have given to the world. And nationalism will come to the fore, nationalism will come to victory in this country, and we will build again a country that is great, strong, proud, free, and white.
So that was the speech he'd been arrested for again and was due in court for again. It's known as the secret agent. Just before we get on to the 11th hour, a call for British rebirth, just a quick note. I may refer to Mr. Tindall as JT throughout, because that's what people did at the memorial meeting recently, so there's no sort of disrespect there. Right, early life, 11th hour. Earliest childhood memories were Finchley, North London. During the Blitz, one bomb fell so close that it rocked Grandma Tindall backwards off her piano stool. Another early memory was of the V1 rockets appearing over the sky. One day, he heard the familiar sound of the machine and rushed outside to see. His mother had rushed back from the shops and ushered the young John Tindall indoors. At the age of 10, the young John Tindall was very interested in maps and atlases. It was at that age that he took note of the size of the British Empire in comparison to Britain itself. He states, "That's when the imperialist within me was born." Father found his vocation during the war, working for the YMCA. He was involved very much with setting up the Meals on Wheels service, a service designed to provide at least one cooked meal a day for old folk who were too infirm to cook for themselves. Incidentally, the Meals on Wheels service is one of the things which have been cut by the coalition government, which was formed in May 2010. Meanwhile, Mr. Cameron has ring-fenced foreign aid at £12.6 billion a year. Age 11 to 17, JT states, his priorities were a little out of balance, which resulted in his studies suffering. JT didn't recognise this, however, and states, didn't regret this, however, and states, rigorous exercise and a good diet served him well all his life. During his teenage years, JT noticed what he referred to as an atmosphere of increasing decay. He detested the architecture of the new towns and cities. He despised the herd-like disposition of what he calls our intellectuals, in quotes, to drool over the deceased creations of a Picasso or Henry Moore. At age 16, he noticed the shallowness of political canvassers who would knock on people's doors with a meaningless smile and who would mouth meaningless platitudes. JT noted the election candidates were sold in much the same way as soap manufacturers would compete to sell their washing powder. The election posters, he recalls, were mere slogans rather than arguments. He compared such posters and boards to advertisement campaigns such as Guinness is good for you or go to work on an egg, what people might call now sound bites. In the early 1950s, JT states that he had not yet realised a two-party hoax was in operation. When the masses get tired of dog number one and want to change, dog number two is brought out the kennel and placed on centre stage. When the dogs meet, they yap and snarl at each other to give the impression they are mutually hostile. Meanwhile, the public is never allowed to know that both dogs are the property of the same owner and perform to his instructions. In the early 1950s, John Tindall spoke to conservatives and learned that their idea of patriotism consisted of a love for free enterprise. He states that the conservative types cared only for material gain and wouldn't even discuss problems that the country had. He was then given some literature by a socialist and saw some true points in it. He learned how the working class had been kept in poverty for generations by reading this socialist literature. The literature spoke of the evils of capitalism, JT reflects. What he was reading about was international, liberal, laissez-faire capitalism, which had been the prevailing form of capitalism, for the most part, in Britain since the Industrial Revolution. That there could be another, alternative concept under which some of the features of capitalism could be retained and made to work for the general good was not something that occurred to him at the time, as of course it was not something suggested in any of the left-wing literature he had been given. The conclusion he came to at the time in regards to socialism was as follows. Have you ever focused your eyes on an object, be it a person, a picture, or some urban or rural scene, and had the feeling that something about it is not quite right? Exactly what you cannot say. Undoubtedly some features of what you are looking is attractive. But a little voice inside you says, don't accept this. There is a flaw somewhere. That is how it was when I looked at socialism. In 1952, at the age of 18, JT joined the army, the Royal Artillery. After training, he was posted to the 4th Regiment Royal Horse Artillery. He recalls arriving at Hone, a lonely spot in the midst of Lüneburg Heath, on New Year's Eve 1953. The barracks, like most used by British forces in Germany, was formerly the property of the Wehrmacht. JT recalled, compared with the hastily built huts in which he had resided in Oxford Street, England, they were most impressive. Hitler, he deduced, must have regarded the provision of good living quarters for his troops a high priority. During his young army stint, JT was promoted to Lance Bombardier. He enjoyed meeting British lads from different parts of the country. He states the officers did not make an effort to keep the recruits busy in their spare time and evenings were boring. He mostly passed away the hours reading books. One highlight was a trip to Berlin via communist East Germany to take part in a cricket match. He recalled he found that fascinating. JT remembers how the German citizens were always courteous and polite and that they were working extremely long hours in 1953 to rebuild that shattered country. In 1954, JT's army career came to an end as he decided to not make a career out of soldiering. He did, however, think national service for young people would be a good idea, and comments, today, when I watch the yobbish behaviour of some of our youthful generation, I am constantly struck by the thought that, had they had a background of experience in the forces, the instances of such behaviour would be greatly reduced. Upon returning, JT rents a cheap room in a warm stay at London's Tottenham Court Road. The office job he took up briefly before joining the army had been kept open for him. Now he had many free hours to explore London. He didn't like much of what he saw. He found the planning of the city poor, with many fine buildings having ugly modern ones built next to them. He noticed many effeminate looking men. He later realised this was the early gay plague that would, as he puts it, sweep through society like a poisonous virus. Many cinemas advertised pornography. Everywhere there was prostitution, depravity, and a feeling of decadence. It was at this time he first noticed many non-British who had set up businesses in London. He describes them as people you wouldn't describe as British. So non-whites, basically. During evening in the YMCA, he would debate politics with middle-class students who were staying there. These students, he soon learned, were all for the rights and independence for India and nations in Africa. When he suggested it only fair the British should want foreigners out as the Indians and Africans had called for whites to get out of their lands, they would have none of it. Several times these young men would break out in rage and shout at him. They also called him racist. JT concluded, rather than being educated at their universities, these middle-class men had been processed. More sense could be had from an uneducated man down the pub over a pint in the East End. At least some notion of patriotism and national pride still existed within them. Whilst in London, JT considered going to teacher training college. For this he would need more O-levels. He gained 2 GCSE O-levels via attending evening school at this time. Dissatisfied with London, he moved back with his family in Lincolnshire, where his father ran a YMCA. At this time, he heard Oswald Mosley had started a new organisation called Europe a Nation. Although impressed by some of Mosley's earlier pre-war ideas, he did not like the idea of a European superstate, which was being promoted by Mosley. Apparently what Mosley was doing after the war, he wanted some kind of, not like the EU, like a group of states who could form a bloc, like the United States of Europe, but John Tyndall didn't see any sense in that whatsoever, because you know, obviously you've got different languages, different cultures, and as the modern European Union has shown, that different countries produce a lot more of certain things, and some are more prosperous than others, and it's just a completely unworkable idea. And so he never sort of followed Mosley during the 50s. He then saw a TV news report on a demonstration by a group calling themselves League of Empire Loyalists. JT decided to track down the group and ended up in the basement office in Bridge Street, Westminster. The man he met explained that they were not a political party but a pressure group. He took home some literature and learnt that the leading light was A.K. Chesterton. He was also the editor of a small journal called Candor. Candor, JT states, first brought him to the understanding of what is sometimes called conspiracy theory. The idea that the great events of recent history and the present were not some chance occurrences, but they were and are the outcome of conspiratorial forces, directing world affairs in a manner entirely different to that explained to and believed in by the masses. JT decided to join the League of Empire Loyalists and help spread A.K. Chesterton's ideas, and perhaps, when older and more mature, contribute something himself to the political debate in which he was engaged. In the literature he had acquired from Chesterton, there was much talk of Jews and their political role, of their involvement in conspiracies, and of their being the originators of communism. He decided to investigate the subject, taking care to avoid what he called the lunatic fringe, who blamed Jews for everything, including the weather. Bit by bit, it became clear to him, in the form of incontrovertible evidence, that there was present in Britain and around the world a definite Jewish network wielding immense influence and power through money, through politics, and through its foothold in some sectors, amounting to virtual monopoly in the mass media. Looking at the productive sectors of the economy, he was not able to perceive any particularly remarkable degree of Jewish contribution. Very few were to be found among the outstanding inventors of real science, pioneers, engineers, and builders. On the cultural level, they had not been particularly prominent among the truly great novelists, poets, painters, composers, sculptors, or architects. Though on the entrepreneur side of the arts, and as agents, financial backers, and critics, they were to be found everywhere. The truth, he found, was inescapable. In not one single case could he find any prominent, powerful, and influential Jewish personage who identified himself or herself with any cause of complementary to the interests of the British nation, to patriotism, to race, or to the empire. He became aware of a strange paradox. While Jews were to be found amongst the most ardent and committed opponents of British nationalism and British race loyalty, they were at the same time the most passionate champions of nationalism and race consciousness on the part of their own people. What they denigrated in Britain, they applauded in Israel among Zionist communities the world over. JT at this time had a chance for a cheap trip to Russia, which was organised by a socialist group. He took the opportunity to visit the country and to debate the socialists organising and taking part in it. He states, "My Russian trip gave me some chance to put to the observation the theory that Jews have provided a large portion of the leading activities of the political left." The group with which I travelled from Britain was about 2,000 in number, and for the purpose of easier management was subdivided into smaller sections of about 30 or so, each section designated as a team and given a team leader. It became clear to me that an exceptionally high proportion of these team leaders were Jews. In the many discussions and arguments in which I became engaged during the trip, I noticed again that the most aggressive and committed proponents of the far-left pro-Marxist viewpoint were Jews. On one occasion, I had the temerity to ask one of them how he managed to square his antagonistic attitude towards everything patriotic in the British context with the ultra-nationalistic outlook of his own people on every question affecting themselves. The answer came not in the form of a reasoned argument, but of a bout of screaming abuse ending in a threat to do me over. When invited to do just that, he muttered something under his breath and walked off. JT recalls his earlier interest in socialist ideas was provided by his revulsion against the self-centred outlook underlying the doctrines of the Conservative Party as it had evolved in mid-20th century Britain and had remained since. Social order and social justice, he reflects, were themes regularly expounded by writers of the left, and to these he could not object. From an early age, JT was a thorough supporter of the National Health Service, as well as most other social services, and he remained so despite the abuses to which so many of these services have been put. Somehow, in his young mind, he states, he equated these social advancements with the left of politics, though in fact almost all of them were present as far back as the time of Bismarck in Germany. In fact, he concluded, there is no earthly reason why the left should be allowed to claim credit for any large portion of the positive achievements of the welfare state, let alone a monopoly of the social ideals that led to it. Socialist propaganda in the early 1950s, however, persuaded him otherwise, and looking back he could see this was in large measure due, again, to the essentially self-centred philosophy of conservatism, as I perceived at the time. Not only did JT regard it as the responsibility of society to care for the sick, he saw it as being at least an equal responsibility to nurture the healthy. As a youngster keen on exercise and fitness, he was appalled at the very low physical standards of many of his fellow countrymen and women. However, any social utopia not built on foundations of national wealth, strength and power is like a house built on sand. To begin with, arguments about distribution of wealth must always follow, rather than precede, the creation of wealth. This much conservatives understood, but they do not seem to understand that the creation of wealth, of which they are constantly speaking, rests first and foremost on possession of the necessary national assets, these being, number one, an industrious, skilled, intelligent, innovative, enterprising, and not least healthy population, moved by a strong patriotic spirit. Two, a homogeneous population, making for national unity. Three, a strong and diverse manufacturing base, enforced by high competence in up-to-date technology, which must incorporate education for technology. Four, national security against external attack. Five, a foreign policy which gives foremost priority to the national interest. Six, a system of government that provides the best possibility of strong, wise and far-sighted national leadership, invulnerable to the pressures of sectional interests and able to embark on long-term national development and planning. 7. Efficient organisation of the nation at all levels of government and industry. JT decided that British socialism, in pursuit of its utopia, is about as hopelessly equipped in its understanding of these things as it is possible to be. All these desirable conditions of a nation's prosperity and welfare require first and foremost an underlying policy of nationalism. A policy of defending and promoting the national interest to the utmost and to realising the full potential of national power. The philosophy of the British left, he came to realise, runs totally contrary to these principles. It puts its trust in international idealism rather than in national capability. It makes a virtue out of national weakness. It is against racial homogeneity and is for race equality. Finally, the left is wedded to a political system that makes effective national government impossible. JT also concludes, and everything here about the left might also be applied in greater or lesser degree to conservatism and to the creed of the Liberal Democrats. For these reasons, despite some initial attraction, John Tyndall could never become a socialist. In the process of his own political development, JT says, I progressed from a position of seeing socialism as a jumble of well-meaning ideals, some perhaps practical, some not practical, to one of identifying socialism, or perhaps more accurately Marxism, as a deadly national poison, formulated for the one purpose of subverting and eventually destroying the British nation, and with it the whole fabric of the civilised world. Since the post-war period, JT notes, the left has become increasingly the champion of every conceivable form of national, social and human degeneracy. Every cult, every habit, every disposition conductive to the weakening of society, people, nation and race, the left has taken up as a cause celebre. Homosexuality, ultra-feminism, race equality, abortion, relaxation of the drug laws, weakening of the police, soft sentencing for criminals, indiscipline in schools, ugliness and decadence in the arts, downgrading of the work ethic, impotence in national defence, and now stating that a certain number of Labour candidates must be women. JT also discusses New Labour's clever policy of lowering the profile of its most militant left-wing zealots. The change was just cosmetic. New Labour is the same as old Labour. The plan worked as Tony Blair was elected Labour Prime Minister in 1997 and immediately relaxed immigration laws and presided over an unprecedented number of third world immigrants entering Britain during Labour's rule from 1997 to 2010. I can remember a talk by Jonathan Bowden who stated the Labour government brought in 300,000 immigrants a year into overcrowded Britain every year while they were in power. JT concludes, sometime around 1957-58, when I was 23 years old, I finally grasped and faced up to the full enormity of the evils forces menacing Britain from all quarters. Now the importance of entering a teaching profession receded almost into nothing. The political struggle had to take precedence over all. He continues, I decided that I would abandon all thoughts of a normal career and concentrate entirely on political activity and continued political studies, working in normal employment only because of the necessity to pay my way in the world and only to the extent of that necessity. JT states at this time he had no thoughts of becoming a leader in the political field. He had started writing articles due to A.K. Chesterton's encouragement and was very pleased to see the first effort in Candor magazine. Shortly after, he went to a League of Empire Loyalists meeting and was persuaded by a friend called John Bean to speak on the platform. Within a few minutes, he realised public speaking was not as hard as he had thought and he had some natural capability at it. These were street meetings, and right from the beginning, people would turn up who were diametrically opposed to what he and his friends stood for. Sometimes there were fights, and we had to act vigorously to defend the platform and our own persons, he states. At every meeting, there were hecklers, and the quick repartee was necessary. John Tyndall no longer had any doubts as to where he stood. He was first and foremost a British nationalist, not in a narrow sense of nationalism as applied to a particular state or territory, but in the much wider ethnic sense of a nation held together by bonds of race. I think that is a good place to leave it for the first show. I'm not sure how many shows it will take to get through John Tyndall's work, 11th Hour. It's 21 chapters and I've done about 4. As it is a summary, not a read-through, I will be skipping parts which are not relevant in future shows, but so far a big proportion of it I've had to include, because if it seems relevant and sounds important, then I shall include it. But now I'm going to play a speech by Richard Edmonds, who was a long-time friend and fellow activist with John Tyndall. He was also a founding member of the British National Party. So this speech was at the John Tyndall Memorial Weekend on the 12th of October 2013. I think you'll like it. So thanks for listening to episode 1 and come back next Sunday to listen to episode 2. Goodbye.
you very much, ladies and gentlemen, fellow nationalists, friends. These meetings play an important role because they allow us to discuss on a very wide spectrum all sorts of important ideas that are germane to us, which are fundamental to us, and we speak here completely outside the normal sort of nationalist party agenda. What I'd like to speak about today is that next year is going to be 2014, which will be the anniversary, the centenary of the 1914, the outbreak of the First World War, the first of the series of what can be described as the suicidal world wars, where millions of white men fought and killed millions of other white men, the very best and the bravest of their generation. Wherever you go in Britain, and wherever you go in France, wherever you go in Germany, every town, every village, every city, even small villages have those war memorials with the dozens and some hundreds, in our case, of British names. Yeah. British names and only British names. 1914, 1918, then underneath 1939, 1945. In August 1914, it was the British government which declared war on Germany. Not everybody's clear about that. It was the British government that declared war on Germany in August 1914. A million British soldiers were killed in that war, and millions more lost their arms and their legs, their health and their eyesight. And no one can tell you, we've never been given any reason, any justification for the British government declaring war against Germany back then in 1914. If you think about it, never been given any explanation or reason for that war in which millions of men lost their lives. And then, just 25 years later, it's staggering when you look back, just 25 years later, the British government, for the second time, and it was the British government, declared war on Germany for the second time, 1914 and 1939. On both occasions, it was the British government which declared those wars. And we have never been given a reason, an explanation, a justification for the British government declaring that Second World War against Germany. And the Second World War was even more bloody, even more destructive than the first. It is estimated that some 60 million lost their lives in the Second World War. And even more were mutilated, wounded, raped, and murdered. And the most destructive war in the history of mankind, which some of us in this hall, I was born in the middle of the Second World War. My father was a soldier. He luckily survived. My mother's brother was killed in that war in active service. And as I say, every town, village and city in Britain, in France and in Germany and other countries has those dozens running into hundreds of names. That was the most destructive war in the history of mankind. At its end, Britain was bankrupt. The British government had to go on its knees and beg for money, beg from the United States of America, because we were bankrupt. I remember that as a kid, we used to live on American dried eggs, powder that was sent over here from the US of A, which our government had to beg for, because the government was bankrupt. So Britain was bankrupt, Europe was destroyed, and the world was taken over by the new powers, the United States of America and the Soviet Union, no particular friends of the white race. And here in Britain, we was installed in the summer of 1945, was installed into government power, a very internationally minded socialist Labour Party, who within a couple of years of coming to power, they came to power and 45, but 1948, that internationally minded socialist government had brought in as law the so-called British Nationality Act, which gave British nationality, or the right to enter into Britain, to all the subject peoples of the former British Empire. One, that British Nationality Act in 1948, passed by the Labour government, gave one quarter of the world's population the right to enter Britain. Before that, prior to that, the subject peoples of the British Empire, the blacks, the browns and the yellows, were not permitted into Britain. That was passed then. I would like to entitle this statement that I'm making here today, the anniversary of a catastrophe. And this was the title of an article that John Tyndall wrote in his magazine back then in September 1979. John Tyndall wrote an article entitled The Anniversary of a Catastrophe, September 39, 40 years on. Now again, it was one of the little stories of the little family that I was brought up in. My mother, as a young woman, my parents got married just before the Second World War started. My father had lived through the First World War as a boy in a barrack town just outside of London. He saw all the troops being forever marched off to France as a boy. They were married just before the war started. They certainly didn't want a Second World War. And my mother, one of the things, all her life, she would say, I remember Chamberlain going on the radio, 3rd of September, and saying, from 11 o'clock this morning, we're at war with Germany. And everybody knew what that meant. That meant slaughter in Flanders again. That meant all the young men being marched off. And she said, my blood ran cold at the thought of it. I've spoken to Germans, since I know quite a few German nationalists, and they said, well, that was rather our experience when we heard that Britain had declared war on us for a second time in 39. So John Tyndall wrote this article, a very powerful article. If anybody really wants a copy and they talk to me nicely, I do mean nicely, and give me a quid or something, and their address, I will photocopy it. It's 6 pages long, this article. There's Chamberlain. There's soldiers in the First World War in the trenches, about to go over the top. So if anybody asks me nicely, I'll give them a photocopy of this. There's some water.
You could put it on the internet, Richard.
Yeah, I could do. Certainly could. I'm going to make a film of this, I think. Anyway, towards the end of this article, John Tyndall, who had a very broad mind and very understanding of people, could sort of look round corners with his mind, so to speak. Towards the end of this article, he says, he asks this question. Some people may ask, what is the point of bringing up these things decades afterwards, when it is the future that we should be concerned about? And John Tyndall replies, and he says, I'm reading this from the back of the magazine, the plain answer is that our ability to determine the future is inextricably, totally bound up with these events, because the powers and the mentality that determined Britain's catastrophic course in September 39, declaring a Second World War, those powers and that mentality are still with us, and they rule our affairs today.
That's right.
And there's absolutely no question of that. They rule our affairs today. So, now, I've had this idea in my head for many years, and I've known of this article for many years. After it's written 34 years ago, this article. Recently, only about 2 or 3 weeks ago, the present mouthpiece of the powers that rule our affairs today, Prime Minister David Cameron, gave us a taste of what we could expect to hear endlessly from the 1st of January 2014 and onwards. Cameron spoke in positive terms of the coming anniversary of the First World War, and Cameron justified that world war in terms of ensuring democracy and free speech. Well, ladies and gentlemen, fellow nationalists, there firstly, there is and can be no no justification of those two world wars. The terrible truth is that those millions of men died for absolutely nothing good whatsoever. And those fallen heroes would turn in their graves if they could see what had become of the towns and the villages and cities that they marched away from, never to return. Yeah. They would turn in their graves. This broken, betrayed Britain that we, their sons and daughters, and grandsons and granddaughters exist in as second-class citizens, dispossessed second-class citizens in a land ruled for the benefit of millions of foreigners who've been permitted to pour in and take us over in a process whose end is clearly our genocide.
Yes.
Our genocide. As we, the native Britons, are displaced with the big sharp elbow and then replaced. You can see where this is heading to. Oh, yes. We've had 50 and more years of this immigration. You can see where it's heading to. Let me have a glass of this. Is lemonade I'm drinking, but nothing stronger. That's lemonade. That's an effect on me, doesn't it? No, nothing like that. I don't need anything like that. I don't need anything stronger than lemonade. If I may say, that phrase that I just used, that those men died for nothing, that actually was a phrase I heard from my own mother, actually. When I was growing up as a kid, I've not always been this height, by the way, when I was somewhere down there, I heard my mother say that about her own brother. She was very bitter, my mother. I've heard her say many times, what good did the brother's death do? What good did it do? She'd ask a sort of rhetorical question, half speaking to herself, then just speaking around our little family, and she'd say, it brought no good whatsoever. No good. No good. My mother was saying this in the 1950s and 60s when I was sort of growing up. So that's where I've had that phrase in my head long before I became an active nationalist. But it's these sort of things that drive us into nationalism, the absolute betrayal of our people. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about politics now, because ultimately it all goes back to that crowd at Westminster, because they're the ones who make the decisions, and they're the ones, as Jim said, we need to push out of it. We need to push them out and replace them by brave men and women. We were on a track, we were doing very, very well at one stage in getting brave men and women elected, and then we had a few hiccups. Ladies and gentlemen, fellow nationalists, I tell you, the future's going to be full of hiccups, to put it politely. The technique is just to persevere. Persevere, get to know good people, support good people, believe in the British people, and we'll get rid of all them bums down at Westminster there. Let me put it this way, let me use this phraseology. We here at these meetings understand the importance of politics. We understand the importance of the role played, for better or for worse, by politicians. Some of them statesmen of the highest calibre, others mediocrities and worse, the Chamberlains and the Churchills. We should know, as active nationalists, we should know it was the Liberal Party in power in 1914 that declared war on Germany. It was the Tory Party in power in 1939 that declared war on Germany the second time round. It was Churchill's coalition government of the three establishment parties who really are just one party, actually. You look at the big picture, that's one party. Yeah. It was Churchill's coalition government, wartime coalition government, Conservative, Labour and Liberal, who pushed the Second World War to its bitter final end, the bankruptcy of Britain, the ruination, the ruin, the destruction of Europe, and pushed it to its bitter, catastrophic end, a catastrophe for the whole white race, with the triumph of the globalists and the internationalists. Because they won that war, and we live in the ruins. When you think, we once had civilized countries. We were once a civilized country. At one time, little English boys and girls, British boys and girls, had a future. Yes. Technically, at the moment, the bitter truth is, no white British person's got a future in this country at the moment, because we're ruled by the internationalists and globalists entirely, as Jim was saying and others would speak, entirely for them, for their gain. Let me come to my point and conclusion now. Next year will be the anniversary of 1914. We can expect, you can predict it, half of us in this room could write the speeches that the Cleggs, the Camerons and the Milibands, they're going to mouth off about democracy and free speech. And the fact is, there is no democracy in this country. We live under an anti-democratic, genocidal tyranny. That is what it is in words. Anti-democratic, genocidal tyranny. Yes. There has never been a debate in this, an honest debate in this country about immigration. Never. There's never been a simple, direct, honest, straightforward referendum, yes or no, to mass immigration. The establishment parties have never been honest with the electorate, with their intention, over 50 years now, to flood us with millions of foreigners, and the clear wishes and expectations and needs of the British people have never been heeded. So that's that. We have no democracy. They've never been heeded. And as for the claim of free speech, successive Labour and Tory governments have passed into legislation, passed into law, race acts. The Labour Party has passed 3 race acts so far. The Tories have passed 1 race act so far, in which wickedly, the truth is not the defence. Truth is no defence. One of the early defenders in a race act trial said to the judge, the member, I'll mention his name in a second, a member of a nationalist party back in the 1980s, he said, I produce a little, Your Honour, he said, I produce a little magazine, he said, and I have in it details of crime, murders, rapes, etc. And everything I say in my little magazine is true, because I'm just lifting it from local newspapers, papers in Halifax, papers in Leeds, papers in Birmingham, papers in South London, North London, and everything. And I give the name of the paper, the Hackney Gazette, 29th of July, whatever. How is this a crime? And the judge said, putting his finger on the brutal truth, the truth is no defence under the Race Act. Now, that is what our laws have come to. That the way they get round it, you mustn't insult coloured people. And they take it that even speaking the truth can be an insult, even though it's true. And so the judge said to this defendant, the truth is no defence. The judge obviously understood completely the law and the implication of the law. How he could sit up there and send this poor devil to jail as he did, I don't know. How he had the conscience, how he lived with his own conscience. But he, in one nutshell, that was the truth. The truth is no. And now, the last race act that the Labour Party brought out, the maximum jail sentence is 7 years in jail. 7 years. Now, it so happens, by a coincidence, on Friday, I was speaking to an American journalist who was interested in all this business with Tommy Robinson and EDL and all that. And he phoned me up trying to get a bit of background of what it's like to be a British nationalist, someone who could sort of give him the bigger picture. And I informed this American journalist about the Race Act. He had no idea that in Britain you can spend 7 years in jail for speaking the truth. He had no idea. Because whatever problems they got in the US of A, at least they've got freedom of speech. He had no idea. And I'll now name three men who paid the price, three British patriots. One was Joe Pearce. It was Joe Pearce, the 1980s, who the judge said to, truth is no defence. Truth is no defence. And then sent Joe to jail. I don't know how these judges can do it, actually. Said Joe Pearce was 21 years of age. The authorities waited until he was 21. Then they did it. Wicked. Cold, isn't it? Cold. Yeah. A boy of 21. You know, a generation earlier, he could be sent to the front, couldn't he? Now they're sending him to jail because he was a brave young man. And the other two names I mentioned were John Tyndall and John Morse, good friends of mine and good nationalists. I will say here, I introduce my words by saying that this is a very, very broad spectrum at these meetings. We're all patriots. If there's one rule, I do think there's one rule, Mr. Chairman, that we don't attack verbally other nationalists. I do think that is the rule here. If there's somebody we don't like, we don't actually say their name. We might say, you know who I'm talking about, but we don't actually... But it is my opinion that some of us who are British nationalists should expose the continuing destruction of this Britain over 100 years. I know that many nationalists, and I understand why, concentrate on crime, immigration, the European Union, and the problems of today. But I have no doubt that these problems didn't come up yesterday. They have been our civilization, our whole race was done enormous damage in them two world wars. The best, the bravest, the volunteers were sent to the front and killed. And it made many, many others cynical and beaten and browbeaten. They thought, oh, not for me. Those two wars did enormous genetic damage to us, but also did a great deal of damage morally by making people cynical. And we have to give our people hope. We have to give them knowledge up here and hope in their hearts and the certainty and the knowledge that we can win and get this crowd out. Yes, thank you. I think there should be some British nationalists, some, who say that the politicians of the establishment then and now are guilty men, guilty then for sending millions of men to their utterly useless destruction, and guilty now for putting this country of ours on a path towards its inevitable destruction. Inevitable destruction unless the present politicians, the present political class, can be wrested from power, and we're going to wrest them from power. Okay? Thanks for that.
Thanks for listening to Voice of Albion on the White Network.